Here's our cycle again, and here is a friend that Robin and I met at a conference on shamanism that we put together about 14 years ago. And this was a shaman from the Shuar, or the Jivaro. They are best known as the headhunters of South America and Ecuador. And we really became friends with this guy. I won't go into all his stories now, but here he is doing a magical ceremony on our land in our stone circle, which you'll see better pictures of later on. And he did one of the most amazing healing ceremonies I have ever seen and experienced in my life in this stone circle. We were up all night drinking ayahuasca and tobacco. I don't like to drink tobacco. I don't like to smoke it either. But those are his magical potions.
And most of the people in the group were themselves healers. And what I was so impressed with by him is his respect for the healers of these other traditions. He's also a master herbalist, and he wanted to spend time in this country learning about analogs between South American herbs and North American herbs. That's his passion. But he was so respectful of all these other healers, and he was fascinated with them, and he would bring them in and out, so they're not just sitting there being inert in the ceremony. He'd say, "What do you see?" If when one person was in trance and being examined, he would say to somebody else, "What do you see with your particular skills in this person?" That kind of thing. It's quite fascinating.
Or as my friend Tom Werner, a professor of psychology and religion at Burlington College, says, both ancient doctors and modern doctors use drugs. The only difference is that the modern doctors give the drugs to their patients and the ancient doctors take them themselves. I think that's a much better model. They better be good drugs if you're going to take them yourself. Okay, so back to my shaman's doorway, the stages of mythic engagement. We realize the first moment that a human being realizes that there is a sacred dimension that interpenetrates everything in the universe. You've got it. This is the moment, the genesis of all spiritual traditions, the power of the mysterium. Rudolf Otto, great scholar of religion, the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the great, fascinating, and terrible mystery of life itself. Then in mythic orthodoxy, of course, the surrounding paraphernalia of the sacred experience get made holy. The place that the vision happened, the surroundings that were around you when the experience happened, what led up to it, what came after it, it's all holy. And then
it's all holy.
Along comes a tradition that says, I'm sorry, all of this nonsense is magical thinking. It's a stage of cognitive development. Then comes this very interesting phase that I want to celebrate while we're here. The principle of what is called the shunyata in Hinduism and Buddhism, the emptiness, agnosticism, probably the most honest of the postures in relation to the ultimate mystery. I told this bad joke at the planning committee, so I apologize for telling it again. Some of you probably didn't hear it. Have you heard about the dyslexic agnostic insomniac? The dyslexic agnostic insomniac lies awake all night wondering if there is a dog.
That's a very shamanic joke. The sacred animal.
So the theme that I'm going to lead up to in the fourth lecture, mythic engagement and renewal, the creative, socially contributive life. It's inevitable in shamanic cultures that the shaman becomes the artist, the musician, the healer, the cultural creative. It just goes with it. And we have been in these cultures where somebody will receive a channeled hymn in the middle of the night, and by the next day, everybody in the community is humming it or singing it. And it might be incorporated into a magical ceremony by the end of the day. It's really wonderful. So my African shaman teacher, Vusumazulu Credo Mutwa, I did a book with him and about him. I don't know whether I managed to get that one along for the bookstore, but you can get it on Amazon, rather cheap. And all the proceeds from that book go to the Zulus. Spirituality and science should walk hand in hand like lovers, not be separated from each other. paradigm clash, including scientific fundamentalism. I'll be talking about that on the third lecture. They are only different if the worldviews that support them are made to be opposed to each other. Why can spirituality not become more scientific, nor science be discovered as a sacred activity? It's a big question of our time. So, here we are in Indonesia. And I will mention to you that Robin and I take our shamanism seriously enough that we've firewalked about 5 or 6 times, but we don't do it like ordinary people do it, because some people like to gallop through the fire pit. We do it holding hands and walking slowly. So if either one of us wants to run away, the other one's got hold of them. And we have not been burned. The one time I was burned was when I walked by myself and my attention wandered, and I had a red-hot coal between my big toe and the next toe. My attention broke, and I went, holy cow, that was wild, and I suddenly felt a burn. But shamanic invulnerability is to say that spirit transcends flesh. Look what I can do with these real little torches here against my chest. And this is a guy who's they don't have any Christmas trees in this culture in Malaysia, so they set this guy up sort of this way, and he's got a thing through his mouth here, and he is decked out for the holidays. And he probably is not in terrific pain. This is part of the trance-like activity of this culture in Malaysia.
Should mention that this is where neuroscience comes in, because we know a number of people who've spent quite a lot of time with various devices on people who were doing these kinds of events, these kinds of
you can hook
experiences
them up
in trance.
You can hook them up to biofeedback devices while they're doing this kind of stuff and see what's happening in their brains, in their skins, in their bodies, in their nervous systems. So when you see these amazing things, these are practiced in Qigong, in Southeast Asian shamanism. You're witnessing a demonstration of shamanic invulnerability. By the way, this is spring steel with a sharp point on it. He's bending it against his chest. It's not going in. He's standing there like a statue with at least a 50-pound steel or iron kris, it's called. And he'll do this for hours. The trance shows that he is capable of conquering the vulnerability, the frailty of the flesh, and so he might be a decent healer as well. So, Robin, why don't you talk about the figure there?
I'm trying to. You'll have to feed me her name again. It just got away.
Ekajati.
Ekajati.
Yeah.
Yes, Ekajati. Well, what fascinates me about this, of course, this is a Tibetan image, but it's a more recent one, and the flames and the lotus petals and the clouds. I mean, you see this in a lot of Tibetan tankas, but in this one, everything in the image is swirling, like with a, it's naked. Its atoms are all showing. That's what I see here. It's just. She is just, you know, here is the little, perhaps this is Shiva's little dwarf, or perhaps who's ignorant and doesn't know what's going on above. Perhaps this is just humanity and mortality and time. But whatever is going on, this is why, in a way, people walk fire. And it's not just to, of course, they're the demonstrations. You know, I can be a healer because I can do this. But it's also reminding ourselves that, and this is what Steve told me one time, and it just stuck with me forever, we're all frozen sun. We're all made of the same atomic stuff. And it's just those spaces, and if you're small enough, those spaces are very big. You can't always pass your hand through the table, but every now and then we get something, we do something that's just stunning. You know, the little old lady who saves her grandson when the car falls. And I mean, these things are amazing, and we see them all the time, really. And walking on fire is about that, too. You realize that the sun is, we're made of it. for a little while, very briefly, hardly consciously. And I see that in this wonderful artist representation. Everything is swirling, everything is burning, everything is alive, and everything sees us.
Tibetan Buddhism contains it all. And I'll tell just a little personal story here. We were up very near Tibet in the Himalayas, and we were looking at one of these amazing Tibetan Buddhist ceremonies where they start out in the morning by blowing a human thigh bone trumpet. They beat little drums made of human skulls. Everything is oriented around death. And there happened to be with us, we were sitting on a wall watching these ceremonies, a Japanese balloonist whose balloon had begun to lose hot air as he was passing over the Himalayas at 20,000 feet or so, and he'd gotten stranded. So he's there, and he's watching the ceremony with us. And he goes, "I don't understand this form of Buddhism. We have Buddhism in Japan. Doesn't look like this." And our 7-year-old son Merlin is sitting on the wall next to him. And he says, "You know, it is the same Buddhism, but there's a little bit of shamanism mixed in with this." So
we're going to
change tracks just a little bit, if we may. And Lorraine very sweetly asked us to put in a little bit of autobiography so you could hear a little bit about our stories and how they fit into the shamanic paradigm, so we're not just talking about something. And Carl Jung says in one of his great books, "I realized it was my task of tasks to find out what myth I was living." He had already rejected the religion that he was brought up with. He had tried various variations of Eastern religion and found them fascinating. He had gone to Africa and studied with shamans, but he wanted to find out what myth he was living. And boy, did he live one. So we'll show you our humble equivalent of the same thing and go into biography. Both Robin and I were born in 1941 on the cusp of what was arguably the most terrible war in history. It's part of my personal mythology. I'm a really, really ardent pacifist, and I don't like war. Now, my parents went through their own dismemberment and dealing with tragedy and suffering. My mother had lost 4 pregnancies before I managed to survive. And she had also watched her little brother die a horrible death at about 5 years of age from, I think it was complications of pneumonia. And there just wasn't antibiotics back in the early part of the 1900s. And so the fact that I survived was kind of astonishing to them. My mother's reaction to all the losses was to become anxious and overprotective, and she showered me with anxiety and overprotectiveness. And my dad also had a nearly fatal pre-antibiotic bout with tuberculosis, and then a broken back. He was a physical education teacher, later to become a minister. I'll talk about that in a minute. He caught a guy who was flying off a gymnastics equipment, and he didn't know it, but he had broken his back in the process. The school authorities accused him of malingering until finally he said, "I think I'm going to try this new thing I've been reading about in the Herald Tribune. It's called the X-ray. Maybe it'll show something." And he tried an X-ray, and he had a shattered lumbar vertebrae, and he was in a body cast for a year. So adversity turns into discovery, and he discovered the writings of Emanuel Swedenborg. It was about a decade and a half after that broken back and recovering from it that he decided he wanted to give up being just a teacher in the public school system and become a Swedenborgian minister. So he was trained and ordained as a Swedenborgian minister. He was given a wonderful parish of a man who had had a great and flourishing congregation and then unfortunately himself died. My dad was not as charismatic, probably, as that man, Adolf Rader, who's a writer of many books, but he conducted more funerals than baptisms, and he became a board member of the Swedenborg Foundation, and during those years, and I remember this very clearly from the 1950s, he went on the road with Helen Keller, Helen Keller had said that, and I brought some books by Helen Keller, a book that the Swedenborg Foundation, which I'm on the board of directors of, she said that she was blind before and now she could see. Once Swedenborg had opened her spiritual eyes, as it were. So because my mother smothered me with cares and anxieties, I went on to do every dangerous thing that I could think of to do. And my favorite sports were motorcycles and karate and rock climbing. And here I am still doing it in 2002. I'm on the flying trapeze, and my son, Merlin, is about to catch me there. He's gotten to be a very big, strong boy and quite a good gymnast and athlete.